Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Contessa's favorite. Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Rate shock, yields jumping on the back of the hotter-than-expected inflation data, the 10-year back above 4.5%, the 2-year closing in on a 5 handle, and today's move signaling the Fed will rethink rate cuts for the rest of the year. We'll debate that. Plus, all the ripple effects from the bump in the bonds, the real estate sector taking it on the chin, small caps struggling to find their footing. We'll go inside the numbers coming up. And later, the options action in the regional banks, a new private company ETF taking Wall Street by storm and bucking the trend. Stock moves catching our traders' eyes in today's volatile market. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. And we start off with the major market moves after yet another hot inflation report. The yield on two-year treasuries spiking towards a 5% mark for the first time since last November. 22 basis point move today. That was the biggest since March of last year. Stocks, meantime, solidly in the red, though off the lows of the day. The Dow shedding more than 420 points. Its seventh day of losses in the last 8 sessions. It is now down over 3.5% from the record hit just last month. And take a look at the drops in some of the most rate-sensitive sectors. Regional banks sinking more than 5%, their worst day since January. Builders dropping below their 50-day moving average for the first time since November. And small cap now negative once again for the year. All this as the latest CPI report showed consumer prices rose 3.5% from a year ago, the third straight month of higher than expected results. That print seemed to squash hopes for a Fed rate cut anytime soon. Chances of a cut in June plunging from nearly 60% before the report to 17% now. And the probability of no cuts at all this year went from just 2% to 13% now. We've been talking about the stickiness of inflation for some time, what this could mean for the Fed. Guy, you especially have been on this.
Well, we're seeing it manifest itself in a lot of different things now. And when you're talking about 10-year yields now, closer to the recent highs now after today than the recent lows of 3.8%, which should be somewhat disconcerting, I think. And when you see moves of this magnitude, I mean, that is alarming. Tim's been talking about this as well. I still think yields continue to go higher from here. Maybe today was the day where the market finally woke up to the fact that yields going higher is not for a good thing. But amongst the many things that stuck out to me today, look at the volatility in the volatility index today. I mean, it was not just a straight line up and stay there. This was a lower than north of 16 and a half, below 15 and a half. I mean, volatility is volatile again, which I think also should be somewhat alarming to people out there.
So we talked about it yesterday a lot about, all right, what if it comes in a little hot, which it came in a little hot. Right. This is sort of not, it's sort of the price action you would expect to have. It did feel like a little bit more scary, a little bit. This, you know, going down for 422 points is actually not that big of a deal. If you step back and look how far it's come, it's just the question of, oh, wow, is it really so? We're not going to get so many rate cuts this year, which we've been talking about for a long time, seemed kind of absurd. We're at the start with 6, and now, I don't know, are we at 2, 1? I don't know where we are now, somewhere in between that, I think. But interesting to me, I like the IWM. I thought we'd broaden out. That did not happen. Surprising to me, though, the Magnificent 4, 7, whatever you want to call it, did pretty well today, right? Most of them in the green or very slightly in the red. And that was sort of surprising to me that that would be a place that people would still feel comfortable as opposed to, oh, wow, I've made so much money in this space. Here's a little, you know, warning shot. Maybe I should sell some. That didn't happen.
But this is data that shows the economy is still good. We're still roaring. And wasn't that sort of the argument behind, you know, if we get hot numbers, it actually shows that we're in a pretty good place, that we can actually continue to grow even with this sort of restrictive territory that the Fed says we're in?
I think we can. And I'm not surprised that the mega cap techs, those that aren't wounded in some way, but the ones that you know, the 3 or 4 that are left are moving higher in a higher rate environment because they have the earnings power. They are certainly less tied to inflation. The dynamic of where Yes, core services were the culprit today on that CPI number. What that means is it's not one, it's not two, it's now three CPIs. And so the jury is certainly not out at all. I mean, it's very clear what's going on. I think we know that the Fed has to be on hold. It's probably September. There's different ways you can be kind of starting to game this. But I look at other things that are also good and bad for the economy. The fact that energy is higher, the fact that commodities are generally higher, these are things that are probably not helping the Fed. Ultimately, they may not be helping the consumer. And I think the view here is that a little bit of a headwind into financial conditions is probably good news for the Fed. No matter what happens here is if we start to see the stock market sell off and we start to get a little bit more inflation around us, I think you're going to see the impact that actually have on rates. I think rates will go higher. I think they could start to go lower before they then go higher. But that's probably, you know, I'm playing 3-6 month tactical game here. I mean, I think right now it does feel like rates can hold this level. Remember, the high of rates was about 5%. In mid-October. Think of the move that the market had as rates came down. I think we've all said equities probably wake up one day, and we don't know what that day it is, but we said a week ago that VIX, we talked about that day, you shot up over 15, and I think volatility is now in the hands of the market.
It's funny, I've said this a few times over the last couple months. I mean, what's going on in the markets and across risk assets in general feels a lot like late 2021. This is the period when the Fed said basically do battle inflation, they're going to raise interest rates, they telegraph what they were going to do. We go into 2022, and they take Fed funds from basically half a percent to 4.5%, and we have a stock market that fairly orderly sells off, let's say 20% or so. Last year, when folks start pricing in the fact that basically they're pretty much done, they did get from 4.5% to the upper band at 5.5%. We're kind of off to the races there. There was some additional liquidity that was added to the markets during the regional banking crisis, which was actually caused by the rise in interest rates, right? So I bring it back to where we are right now. A lot of things feel kind of similar in many ways to me. And it was the last bastion. You just mentioned this Fab Four that actually saw money flows into them today. They were green on this sort of day. And so that reminds me a little bit of late 2021. So I say to myself, if the next move is pricing out rate cuts and then possibly raising rates, that just can't be good for equities, in my opinion, ones that have really just acted, in a pretty reasonable sort of manner this whole period. So at some point, there's going to be something that happens that causes people to sell everything all at once. You know, the dollar today, we saw that, what was going on. We saw what was going on with yields. Gold wasn't even down a whole heck of a lot. Crude hangs in there. And I said to myself, okay, if this is all predicated on the fact that today's number, Friday's number, it says that the economy, like you just said, is okay. Well, sooner or later, the long and variable lags of interest rates going higher should kind of affect the economy, and thus, these multinationals are not going to have the sort of margin, that they have had, and that's going to be a pressure on S&P 500 earnings. And at some point, you discount that. I don't know.
The backdrop, though, to this time around in terms of interest rates where they are is that the consumer is a lot weaker, in theory, than before. I mean, right now, households have spent down all of their pandemic savings. They've taken on credit card debt. The rates on credit cards are now at record highs. So they could really be facing difficulty, particularly when you're talking about higher. We talked yesterday about electricity prices. The average bill year on year has gone up 2 to 3. It's only 2 to 3% of household spending. Gasoline is only 3% of household spending. But that's the bill that consumers open up and say, I'm paying more. And then you add to this auto insurance, which is up 22% in the CPI report. I mean, all these things hurt, even just psychologically, they hurt.
So the consumer is combating inflation, which we've established as a problem, with credit, which is a probably as big a problem. And I don't know how that particularly ends, but in terms of the inflation story, I mean, Jeff Curry is a legend in our world. He was at Goldman Sachs for 2 decades. He's the Carlyle Group now. He was on Squawk Box this morning. And he says, you know, if it was just a couple of commodities, I wouldn't be that concerned. But he talked about it being across a swath of different commodities, soft commodities, industrial metals, obviously, precious metals and energy. And he's concerned by it as well. So it's there. The fact that people are still thinking that rate cuts somehow make sense to me, or that 6 in the first place made any sense, was preposterous. Now I think the market's starting to figure out, wait a second, maybe rate hikes is something we should have a conversation about.
For more on inflation and what the Fed minutes out today revealed about the likelihood of rate cuts, whether or not there could be a rate hike in the cards, let's bring in CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Liesman. Steve, always great to have you with us. I mean, at what point is it not a blip, not a bump in terms of these inflation readings, Steve?
Well, you know the old saying, 2 points to draw a line, 3 points to draw a trend. Or there's the other saying, which is 3 strikes and you're out. I think we're there, but I don't think we're actually out. Let me just tell you what comes next. in the next sort of story of inflation. We start tomorrow, guys. Near term, we have the inflation action continues with the wholesale price report. That's supposed to be better behaved than consumer prices, believe it or not. Maybe you're skeptical, maybe you should be. All the closely watched indices there, you could see, are supposed to come down. That'll be good news, and that'll lead to a better forecast, or a more accurate forecast anyway, for the core PCE. That's the Fed's preferred inflation indicator. You can see that's been running about a percentage point better than the CPI. Has shown some increased improvement, better than the CPI. We'll get that report at the end of the month. Now, futures markets, remarkably, kind of getting to what Tim was talking about, they're clinging to this belief that the Fed's going to cut just further on down the road than before. Take a look at these probabilities. As you guys reported, we got rid of the possibility almost of a June cut. That's 18 now or 20 compared to 58 before the number. Doubt about July, but what happened? Still 66 for September. So, hey, a post-Labor Day cut is now the bet rather than one just after Memorial Day. But who's thinking about vacation and days off? Not me. There's still some reason to forecast cuts besides just grasping at straws, but it's not going to happen unless inflation starts to decline consistently. What comes next? Well, rate cuts if inflation falls higher for longer if it doesn't. I just think, Melissa, the idea of a cut still out there. I've been right in forecasting a lot fewer cuts than the market has, but I still think, and I'll give you one very good reason. According to the Fed's own framework, even if they cut 25 or 50, they would still be restrictive. So they need the precondition to cut, but they already have the reason.
Okay. So three strikes were out. Three strikes is a trend. And I'm just wondering, Steve, if a rate hike could be anywhere out there now.
I don't think so. And it sort of relates back to my last answer. Mm-hmm. The two options I believe on the table for the Fed, I could have this wrong, are holding at the current rate or cutting. The reason I don't have the hike in is because the Fed, by its own measures or metrics, is restrictive relative to where even inflation is at this higher rate. I think that's important to understand. The Fed is probably, I don't know how you want to measure it, a percentage, 150 basis points, 200 basis points restrictive. If it took 25 or 50 off the top, it would still be restrictive by that metric. What we do need is what Dan was talking about before. We need the economy to start acting in practice the way the Fed has constructed the economy to act in theory.
Steve, it's Karen. Thanks for being on. Do you think that there is anything holding the Fed back politically, let's say, from if they wanted to cut it sometime before the election? June's,
you know,
off the table.
Look, I've been looking at these the data. The Fed seems to act when the Fed seems to feel it needs to act, according to most calculations, and it's kicking a bunch of heat for it. You remember the first Bush administration in the 90s, it took some heat for that. There have been times it's cut during election season and not. I think Powell, all things being equal, would like to get it done well before the election or act after the election. I just wonder, guys, when we look back at this, I'm fascinated by your perspective. Does a cut before, right after Labor Day going to matter that much if it comes rather than one that was right after Memorial Day? I don't think down the road it's going to matter all that much.
All right. Steve, thank you.
Pleasure.
Steve Liesman. Our next guest says equities have topped for the year. Damp Spring Advisors founder Andy Constant joins us now. Andy, great to have you with us. Does this mean that we're going to see these rates go even higher, perhaps?
Right. So I think, Melissa, that's the question, which is equities will only respond, we will only get a tightening of financial conditions if rates do, in fact, go higher. You know, Steve just mentioned the framework around the Fed and its claim that conditions are tight in theory, are restrictive in theory. I think he's right. It's just not in practice. And that could be because the economy can handle higher rates, which would mean that if it were not restrictive now, that inflation will stay higher for longer. And so I think until we actually see some evidence of a restrictive economy, which would be widening credit spreads, falling equity prices, widening risk premiums on assets, including term premiums on bonds, higher mortgage rates, the economy is going to still run very hot. And you can tell that not by looking at the very shortest expectation of Fed cuts, but you look out to 2 years now. And over 2 years, only 107 basis points of total cuts are priced in. So they're not going to cut much for almost 2 years. And so that just tells you that the economy is strong, and it'll take more for higher rates and mostly higher long-term rates for the economy to turn over.
Sounds like, though, then the Fed would have to reevaluate what it believes is restrictive and sort of configure that framework that Steve was talking about. Do you think that the Fed is getting it wrong right now?
Well, I think they do consider financial conditions, broad financial conditions, in their framework. They focus, and there's a myopic behavior that particularly we saw in Waller's speech in December around this very short-term real Fed funds rate that Steve described. But they also have mentioned that when rates were at 5% in October, that higher rates was doing some of the Fed's work for them, and they would not have to cut because long-term rates were higher. Since then, they fell 110 basis points to the lows at the end of the year and are finally starting to climb back up. But at this point, they're not anywhere near as restrictive as they were in October. So I think they consider financial conditions, but they do have this myopic approach toward real Fed funds rate that seems to have backfired a bit.
Hey, Andy, it's Tim. So let's drill into this 10-year auction, and we spend time with you, and we should all be spending a lot of time focused on this refunding cycle and the ones coming. But to oversimplify your answer, what's causing higher yields? Is it the macro? Is it that the buyers who, you know, typically have been more aggressive, and there's certainly been a secular trend that's been going on not just this year but for a couple of years, or is it purely the size of these auctions? What is the biggest ingredient to this move higher in rates?
So I think three things, but certainly the rates started moving higher when the last QRA came out, which was on February 1st. You started to see a significant increase in long-term interest rates. And that was because the market was not prepared for $538 billion of new coupon issuance in Q2, nor were they prepared for the fact that it's likely to be $1.5 trillion of total supply of new coupon issuance between the beginning of Q2, which we're in, through year end. So there's $1.5 trillion that has to get absorbed. That's certainly impacting bond yields right now. The other thing is that you're seeing rising inflation expectations, which are partly mechanical with increasing in oil prices, but also in other commodity prices, but also somewhat in expectations that the Fed has paused a bit too long in dealing with inflation, has let it get away from them a little bit. And you can see that in things like gold.
Andy, it's Karen, thanks for being on. How does the sort of discussion around reducing QT, slowing QT, how does that sort of fit into what Tim brought up on the other side?
Right. So if they taper QT, which I fully expect them to do in the minutes today, they mentioned it. It may not be in the May meeting, but it's certainly likely to be in the June meeting. They do have some concerns about the uneven distribution of reserves amongst the banking system, which is a small part to be concerned about. So I do expect them to taper. But once again, taper just means that they require less issuance from the U.S. Treasury to pay them back. Because, you know, as you know, we do runoff at the Fed in that they just let bonds mature. In this case, they'll reinvest some more of the proceeds from that maturing. And they've handed the monetary ball to the Treasury. So to the extent they taper, that reduces the amount of issuance the Treasury has to use. If the Treasury then decides to keep coupons still at this $500 billion net per quarter and just reduce bills, the taper won't be felt by the economy and it won't be felt by the markets. If they choose to reduce coupons and reduce the amount of supply of duration that the investment community has to buy, then that would have an impact on taper. So I think by May 1st, when they do the next quarterly refunding announcement, we'll have an answer on how they're going. We may have an answer on how they plan on changing composition.
Andy, always great to see you. Thank you. Andy Constant, Damp Spring. Guy?
It's a really interesting conversation in terms of what do higher yields mean for the broader market. That's what we're tasked to do, right? Maybe if it's a 4.5% where things start to get interesting again and the market's waking up to it today. But, you know, I think Tim's question is to why are rates going higher? That hits the nail on the head. And they're going higher, I believe, for the wrong reasons. Issuance being one of them. It's a supply-demand thing. And not that we have to get into it now, but you're starting to see the ramifications in different currencies, not least of which dollar yen, which exploded today to the upside. The weakness in yen today was something that I'm telling you, over the next couple of weeks, the network will start talking about this in earnest.
That's intervention territory.
Yeah, and they, in fact, they were kind of at this place a month ago, and everybody knows what they need to do. And the irony is, of course, that what they need to do is actually, you know, by getting away from YCC and really, it should implicitly bring their currency up. So, you know, in terms of the dollar amount down against the dollar. But I just look at where we are with rates. I would argue this has been a 3-year move higher in rates. This hasn't just happened overnight. There's been a lot of volatility within this. And during this 3 years, we've had a remarkable equity rally. At some point, you know, equity investors have to do the math on this. We just haven't done it. And the question we're figuring out is what's that sensitivity level on 10 years?
Coming up, cars, real estate, and private investing. Tesla tumbling on price target cuts. The real estate sector sinking as rates rise, and how one firm's new ETF is letting investors get in on private companies. That CEO will join us in just a few. But first, some fast movers catching our eyes in today's sell-off. How our traders are handling these stocks when Fast Money returns.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. On a day when many stocks took a turn for the worse, we want to take a look at a few names that managed to close in the green. Let's start off with Taiwan Semi, the chipmaker, up slightly today after posting its fastest monthly revenue growth since 2022 as it continues to ride the AI boom. Of course, a major supplier to NVIDIA as well as Apple. Dan, what did you make of this news?
Well, here's the thing. They got kind of easy comps if you just look at like what they, you know, what went on from 2022 to 2023, and now we have 2024, and we all know where these guys sit and who their customers are and the demand for their products and services. So great news. I just get to a point where we're not going to be so far away where one of these companies are going to disappoint on those expectations, and the stocks are trading at levels we haven't seen from a valuation standpoint in a long time, and they seem to be very concentrated. So to me, I'm just saying, keep an eye on this, because again, this was in a rocky market. The stock was probably poised to do a whole host of great things, amazing things in a green market. It just happened to be the one day that we were red. So at some point, though, we're going to have disappointing guidance in the next few weeks from one of these big names. And I think it probably, you know, it's probably going to be a knock against the SMH.
Next up, Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce giant, solidly in the green today, up over 2%. That's on news that co-founder Jack Ma touted the success of the company's reorganization in an internal memo. Ma also bringing up the potential for AI in Alibaba's business. Tim?
Interesting. For a stock that's been stuck in a 10% range between 71 and 78, this isn't a reason to take it higher. The reasons to take it higher, they're also, though, talking about more growth. They're talking about price cuts in AliCloud. They're actually focused on some of that business. Their international business, which is growing 40% a year. They're talking about cost cutting, and the domestic commerce is getting better. It's all going to come down to what the government wants this company to do. That, to me, is what's been the ball and chain on the stock. So it's great to hear about AI, but they're not the kind of folks to get the AI pixie dust.
All right, lastly, Macy's, the department store settling its proxy fight with activist investor Arkhouse this morning. Macy's saying it will add two new directors to its board, both of whom were Arkhouse nominees. This, of course, comes as Arkhouse continues its effort to take Macy's private. Shares of Macy's initially fell in the news, but surged in the afternoon to end the day up more than 2.5%. Karen.
Sort of an interesting turn of events here. I mean, Macy's sort of must be a little bit worried they would have lost the proxy fight. They didn't want to face that. And if they're not certain these guys are real buyers, say, okay, you have some real guys on your men and women, but these are two men they put on the board who are real people to be on the finance committee to help evaluate if, in fact, they can come to a deal. So a mild positive, I would have thought it, I mean, a bad day to trade on this, but I think I would have thought it would do a little better than it did.
There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Tesla rolling downhill. As Wall Street gets even more bearish on the name, why the company seems to be losing its charge. Next. Plus, rates crushing the real estate sector. REITs tanking after this morning's hot CPI data. And housing stocks are standing on shaky foundation. How this space can hold up as yields keep climbing. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Tesla dropping today after more analysts lowered their price targets. Bank of America cutting its estimate to $220, citing the company's choppy Q1 deliveries. Jefferies, meantime, keeping its hold rating but lowering its price target $20 down to $165. That's 3.5% lower from here. Jefferies analysts saying Tesla's troubles appear self-inflicted and could keep its core auto performance lagging for up to 2 years.
Correct. I thought it, given the tape, given that commentary, I thought the stock would be a lot lower. It's not. I actually think it traded relatively well today, all things being equal. And those 163 lows, you can go back a couple months, go back a couple weeks. I mean, we held there like a boss, as folks will say. So I don't know. I don't think you're pressing shorts here. Dan would probably agree with that. I think actually, believe it or not, you can play this from the long side in earnings.
Really?
And I'm not saying anything about the company. This is trading the stock. They report on the 23rd. I mean, this probably could surprise people as we sort of get closer to the date.
Well, wouldn't you want self-inflicted wounds as opposed to exogenous inflicted
sure,
wounds?
Sure, but it seems
right?
like there are exogenous.
Right. I do think, though, okay, so a lot of the bloom is off the rose, but the multiple is, that bloom is still
there.
Fresh.
Full bloom.
I don't know how
full
much bloom needs to come off the rose before it's a buy. I don't know.
I mean, it depends on if you have to start thinking it's an auto company, in which case a lot of bloom has to come off that road.
Yeah, I think, the AGM is something that right. I mean, what do you do around that? And maybe there'll be some answers to priorities around leadership and products. And these are questions the market wants, because frankly, market's not going to be responding to the numbers. Gross margins are coming down. Mm-hmm. Revenue numbers are coming down. Part of these downgrades are more mechanical. I mean, this is what happens. You get to see the numbers. You have to change your model.
Right.
We saw this on the way up. They're still going to generate $2 billion in free cash flow, probably, if CapEx stays more or less in line. And that keeps people in the analyst community, I think, they can stick to a bullish case. It's not my case. And I think the stock's really expensive.
Yeah, let's just say the bear cases for the street, and a lot of these reports have those. They're getting down towards that kind of $125 level. I think you probably take a little bit of that bloom off of the road. I think as long as Elon's there, I think that a lot of folks that are investors and never sell, that makes them feel really good about the longer term story. But the near term, you might get a rally into the print, but I think you'd probably sell it and sell it again, because I don't think the fundamentals of the EV business are getting any better anytime soon.
Coming up, real estate tumble, the home construction ETF on shaky foundation today after the CPI report. CNBC's Diana Olick will walk us through the damage and where it can go from here. And it's not just for VCs anymore. Retail investors can now get in on the startup game thanks to the recently launched fund Destiny Tech 100. The founder and CEO will share his approach and the hottest tech names to watch.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks dropping after this morning's hot consumer inflation report, but closing off the day's lows, the Dow dropping more than 400 points, its seventh negative session in eight. It was down 580 points at its lows of the day. The S&P down nearly 1% and the Nasdaq down about 0.8%, snapping a three-day winning streak. Shares of Boeing lower again today, notching its eighth straight day of losses, its longest losing streak since September. The stock is now down 34% this year as the plane maker continues to deal with safety concerns and production issues. And a pharma deal crossing the wires within just the last hour. Vertex Pharmaceuticals agreeing to buy biotech company Alpine Immune Sciences in a $4.9 billion cash deal, which is expected to close later this quarter. Regeneron, meantime, lower after the DOJ filed a complaint against the company alleging fraudulent drug prices. The DOJ also opening a formal antitrust investigation into the U.S. Steel Nippon deal. Meantime, today's hot inflation report having an outsized impact on the real estate space, the sector the worst performer on the S&P, with REITs like Boston Properties, Kilroy Realty, and Hudson Pacific sinking between 6 to 9%. The home construction ETF ITB falling almost 5% and dropping below its 50-day moving average for the first time since November. Let's bring in CNBC's Diana Olick for more. Diana.
Well, Melissa, REITs are rough today because higher interest rates mean tougher deal making and tougher refinancing. The usually strong apartment sector, take a look. Alexandria Properties down close to 5%, Camden down 3%, and Equity Residential also down. Equity, though, still up year to date. Digital Realty, I mean, who doesn't love AI, but no love there today. Still way up, though, year to date. And office, as you said, Boston Properties way down 6% as office vacancies nationwide hit a record high. And that's why we're seeing this drive to convert office to residential. And that's what you're seeing here at Pearl House in Lower Manhattan, a 1970s office tower, now a 30-story luxury apartment building converted by the Van Barton Group, but only 5 to 8% office conversions actually work due to zoning laws covering location and age of the building, basics like windows, which usually don't open up in offices but have to in apartments, and that can be a financial deal breaker.
I think it's when you start to have multiple strikes against you, right? It's the window combined with deep floor plates, combined with, you know, infrastructure that just doesn't support it. You know, the first thing we look at too is the neighborhood. Will it support? Is it a good place to live?
And you're also usually not allowed to add to the building space. So what they did here was really cool. They took out, actually closed off an interior dark section and added that eligible square footage to these top level penthouses. Melissa, those rent for up to $10,000 a month.
Now, what exactly do they do with the space that's dark? Because it still exists, right? They're just not using it.
They close it off. They wall it off so that it supposedly no longer exists as residential space. And it's in the interior of the building, which is too dark. Everybody wants windows, right? And that's because it was an office building. So they wall it off. They take that extra eligible space and they put more stories up top.
Is it storage?
It's
just, look at the closet
just,
space.
Exactly. There's literally nothing in it. There's nothing in it.
That's great. That seems insane. That's fascinating.
But Diana, you get the penthouse.
Yes, absolutely. It just seems like they should be able to monetize that empty, dark storage space.
Space. They did.
Yeah, I guess they did. That's true. Diana, thank you. Diana Olick. Sure. It's interesting, you know, in terms of these declines, considering we had that big Blackstone deal earlier this week for apartment income, which was, you know, they said we think that's close to the bottom in terms of the real estate market.
Look at the name like Simon Properties since October lows, which many think. I mean, this stock rallied almost 60% off the lows. Maybe justifiably, I don't know. In the absence of bad news, all these stocks sort of levitated. But now it's a different conversation, right? So this is a stock that reports at the end of the month. I'm not suggesting anybody short anything, but if you've been long these stocks, you got to take a hard look at whether you want to stay long at this point.
So the REIT space sort of been interesting. You know, there are transactions, which often when you start to see activity, that's a sign of a bottom,
right?
Because things have to get done. I am short the KRE. However, I am long NYCB. Remember when I put that trade on? So that's sort of right at the crosshairs of the problematic part of the market. We'll see. Hopefully that capital raise was enough for them. They're going to report earnings soon.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's not. There's not a linear relationship between where rates were at the peak at 5% and what stocks will do. But the move in the XHB from that peak in rates, so that low point in the XHB, which was somewhere probably around $70 to where it is close to 60%. We know that the fundamentals for a lot of the builders are impressive. We know what demand is. But to me, this is a story that I think has to get worse. Now, I was wrong the first time, but I look at where demand is going, and I don't think that's changing. It's just about supply and velocity, and mortgage rates are moving higher. So fascinating move. A lot of these interest rate sensitives seem like they're setting up for another round.
Coming up, a new fund allowing retail investors access to the hottest private companies. Destiny founder and CEO Sohail Prasad joins us next to talk about his fund and the outlook for startups. And do not miss an exclusive interview with Amazon CEO Andy Jassy. That is tomorrow, 8:30 a.m. on Squawk Box right here on CNBC. Meantime, Fast Money's back in two. Mark your calendars for Cities of Success, Denver and Boulder, two powerhouse economies that have risen above the rest in Colorado, premiering tomorrow, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on CNBC. Meantime, retail investors now have a way to buy into some of the most talked about names in private markets thanks to a newly listed fund. Destiny Tech 100 currently holds 23 companies, including OpenAI, SpaceX, and Stripe. Investors seemingly on board with shares now up more than 500% since its March 26 debut, but seeing major price swings along the way, down 12.5% just today. For more on the private market approach, we are joined by Destiny founder and CEO Sohail Prasad. Sohail, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just to be clear, this is not an ETF. This is a closed-end fund. So once you invest, you're in, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. In terms of how the stock has been trading or how the fund has been trading, as you mentioned, astronomical gains. But the value of the underlying assets is under $53 million as of December. Should it be trading here at such a premium?
Yeah, what we've seen is it's kind of become a cultural moment. These are companies that any other time in history would have been public companies, but over the last 10, 15 years are remaining as private companies. And so people have thought about different ways to access these companies, and there's never been a liquid, transparent way to do so. So that's been driving a lot of interest that we've seen across the market.
So that froth, that premium, whatever you want to call it, that's because of the scarcity value of this.
I think the market is still discovering it. Most people haven't heard about Destiny yet. And right now there's people being like, wow, I can finally access these companies that I know and love and hear about every single day.
Give us a sense, because, you know, we could go to Stripe. I mean, these are companies that have been around a long time. They've been in the private markets. Most of us who've been in the markets for a while, you would have expected these companies to come public. What was the moment, you know, was there a light bulb that went off or something in your head saying that this is going to be a trend that continues for a while?
Yeah, it was 5 years ago, actually. I was 25. My dad finally asked me, what should I invest in? And I told him, I don't know, SPY or QQQ. But it really made me think about why wasn't there an SPY or QQQ for private tech? I founded the largest secondary market for private shares, but that only touches a very small fraction of the world. And so that's what we set up to build, is something that anyone can access from their brokerage account that invests in these companies that shape the future of every industry as we know it.
So let me ask you, you have the NAV of 484. Is that NAV what you paid for those stakes to put into this?
We mark,
or what? How do you determine that?
Yeah, we mark our NAV quarterly, and we have an independent firm that assists us in kind of valuing the portfolio on a fair value basis.
Talk about portfolio construction, and again, you know, we all know what Qs are. We know what SPYs are. They are, you know, the market cap weighted. How do you think about construction? How do you think about number of positions? And I assume there's not a liquidity mismatch because of the closed end nature of the fund. But, you know, someone that's run a hedge fund, the biggest thing investors usually say is, you know, they've got this liquidity, but I see these assets. This doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's a great question. So when we decided to list this, we had a decision to make. Are we going to list with zero companies? Are we going to wait until we go to our target of 100? We decided we would start with the first 20 to 25, in our case, 23. And we then went forward and listed this publicly. So the rest of our building is going to happen in public as we expand the portfolio over time.
How did you determine, like, is there a committee that selects the companies that are in this?
Yeah, so the big challenge in the private markets is there's not enough liquidity on a day-to-day basis in the underlying. So what we actually do is we go forward and we say, okay, we publish on our website the eligibility and inclusion criteria. We then go and say, these are the metrics that we look at for companies. And that is something that people can look at and see how we think about investing. Over time, because we have the transparency of a public fund, they'll be able to see these are the positions, this is how it's evolved, and then make their own view as to the fair value of the fund.
It sounds like there's going to be a tremendous lag, though, in terms of determining that the value of the underlying assets and having the investor actually know what that's worth.
Well, one of the nice things about being traded on the NYSE is that every single day the public is determining what the value is that they're willing to pay today.
All right. So, well, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
All right, Destiny 100. What do you
good ticker.
Yeah.
Yes.
DXYZ.
Right.
Well, if it's a given that typically companies come to market and there's not a lot of meat left on the bone, then obviously, you know, private markets, by definition, have been a more attractive place to invest. And as Dan's pointed out, a lot of these companies are companies that made a decision to stay private. It's not that they couldn't go public.
Right.
You know, you have to think about fees. You have to think about, you know, what you're actually paying both for the underlying fund, but also the fees to get them. Sometimes there's a load to get in. There's bid ask between some of these sellers. People that are selling, you know, shares are, you know, it's what the market will pay. Again, that's where liquidity works against you.
All fair, but it's an avenue. It's a new avenue into a world that historically has been very difficult people to access. So, you know, congratulations, I say.
It's fairly liquid, actually. I mean, it did trade 4.5 million shares today,
yeah,
which is kind of surprising. Although, to me, it's always about NAV versus where
right,
they
where
are
trading.
Right.
Yeah. And that's
interesting.
Big right now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Coming up, a huge slate of bank earnings kick off on Friday, and options traders are betting that the regionals could make some of the biggest headlines when those reports hit. We'll dive into the action next. More Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, and Citi kicking off a big slate of bank earnings on Friday with the regionals on deck next week. Those names got hit hard today after the CPI print, with the KRE down about 5%. And options traders are betting this is the beginning of an even bigger drop for this group. Mike Coe has all the action. Hey, Mike.
So KRE, the regional bank ETF, saw a big uptick in options trading volume, puts out pays and calls by about 3-1. On more than 3 times the average daily put volume. Now, the busiest contract were the 43 strike puts that expire at the end of next week. But the largest trade was actually in the June 45 puts. We saw a buyer of 10,000 pay $1.54 for those. A big bet that the weakness that we saw in the regional banks today could continue through June, and that would represent a decline of more than 7%.
Dan, I feel like I should go to you on this, because higher rates mean potentially more troubles for the regionals.
Yeah, you know, I don't mean to make it sound like I'm making too close of a comparison, but I go back to 2008 and I think about, you know, Bear Stearns going under and all the stuff that went in and around that. And that was March, early March of 2008. And a lot of folks thought that was kind of dusted, S&P rallied, all that sort of stuff. And then we got into the summer and there was a lot of problems. There was a lot of problems everywhere. And I almost feel like here we are now, we're bookending this move in rates. You know what I mean? We're getting back towards those levels that caused some problems in the regional banking sector. And I just wonder if there's something else lurking here. And who knows? We've spent a lot of time on commercial real estate. We've spent a lot of time on private credit. A lot of things that, you know, again, I don't think there's been any resolution so in the last year or so. But I don't know. I mean, I would not be a buyer of the KRE here.
You're short KRE, mm-hmm, right?
I
as
am.
Part of your trade with NYCB.
Yes.
Long.
Right.
Do you think that this also rise in rates also hurts Bank of America once again? That's what it was.
Well, obviously, they still have that big hold to
yeah.
maturity problem. So, yes. But does it help someone like JP Morgan? Yes, it mm-hmm. does. And so, I mean, I think they're in the big money center bank, particularly the JP Morgans, really benefited from the problems that we saw last year. I think we'll see some one-offs. But this is nowhere remotely close to it.
I think you're going to hear the money center banks tout the profitability of net interest income and as they look forward. But there's no question that the regional banks have a lot of real estate exposure. And there's no question that the held to maturity security portfolios, the longer we stay high and as we move higher, I mean, it does put more stress on these companies.
All right. Mike Coe, thank you. Up next, final trades. Do not miss the CNBC Financial Advisor Summit on Wednesday, May 22nd.
Oh,
we'll hear from top investing experts, including our own Tim Seymour. You're
that.
An investing expert? Just kidding. Scan the QR code to register or visit cnbcevents.com/FA. Time for the final trade. Tim Seymour.
Yeah, big shout out to Fast Money fans and Ranger fans, the Madsen girls. That's right. And Boeing. I tell you what, I think we bottomed here after 8 straight down days.
Karen.
Yeah, Dan's going to hate this, but I like JP Morgan option spreads going into the print on Friday.
Dan.
Yeah, shout out here. Guy was not voted Sexiest Man Alive in People magazine in the first 50 years, but maybe in the next 50. So happy birthday, People. That's where my sister's at. And BKX in the cellar.
Guy.
Hope springs eternal. Letter M, Mel. I think it was an interesting move today. Yeah.
Thank you for watching Fast. To see you back here tomorrow at 5. Meantime, Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.